A rare deadly attack in Iran. Reuters' Lucy Fielder reports.
At least 24 people killed when unknown gunmen fired at a military parade in Iran's south, state television said. They aimed to stand where Iranian officials were watching an annual event to mark the start of Iran's 1980-88 war with Iraq. Parades were taking place across the country. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani addressed this one in the capital, Tehran. Many of those killed were Revolutionary Guards, the sword and shield of clerical rule since Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution. There was no claim of responsibility. Foreign Minister Javad Zarif blamed regional terror sponsors, which would usually refer to Iran's regional enemies Saudi Arabia and Israel, and their U.S. backers. He pledged a decisive response.
That's Reuters' Lucy Fielder reporting. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Charles Grassley has given the woman who has accused Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault until 2:30 this afternoon to decide if she will testify next week. The newspaper reported that Grassley sent an email to Christine Blasley Ford's lawyers that said that the Senate panel absolutely must hear by 2:30 p.m. about Ford's decision. The Senate committee had given Ford until 10 p.m. Friday to make a decision, but her lawyer asked for a one-day extension just minutes before the Friday deadline. The death toll has risen to 167, and one survivor was reportedly rescued Saturday from the ferry boat that capsized in Tanzania's Lake Victory Thursday. Officials there continued their search inside the overturned vessel for third day Saturday as an investigation into the mishap got underway. Search teams spent the day pulling bodies from the boat, which sank. Amid speculation, it was overcrowded as 4 days of mourning began for victims. This is VOA News. Pope Francis will seek to praise Baltic citizens while Russia concerns remain. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma.
Lithuania, Latvia and Estonia, each with ethnic Russian minorities, are also in lockstep in sounding alarms about Moscow's military manoeuvres in the Baltic Sea area following Russia's 2014 annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula and its support of separatists in eastern Ukraine. The Vatican, however, has been loath to openly criticise Moscow or its powerful Orthodox Church. While seeking to avoid offence, Francis will likely praise the sacrifices of those who fought for independence a century ago during Russia's revolution and suffered again during Soviet rule. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Brazilian police have arrested a Lebanese man whom the United States suspects is one of the major financial backers of Hezbollah, the Lebanese militant group. Assad Ahmad Barakat was arrested Friday in the Brazilian city of Foz. The town is situated in the so-called tri-border area where Brazil, Argentina, and Paraguay converge. The area has long been known as a haven for smugglers, traffickers, and counterfeiters. U.S. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein has commented on allegations reported in the New York Times that he suggested President Trump be secretly recorded or removed from office. AP's Eric Tucker.
Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein has denied that this took place. He has said it's untrue and inaccurate, and he's referred to anonymous sources who have their own agenda. But I should also note the Justice Department did issue a statement from somebody who was in the room saying, I do remember the remark. It did happen, but it was obviously meant in a sarcastic way.
And the comments came in response to a story published in the Times saying Rosenstein made the suggestions and the spring of 2017 during upheaval over the firing of FBI Director James Comey. China has canceled trade talks with the United States. This is following Washington's imposition of new tariffs on Chinese goods. The Wall Street Journal reports that China had planned to send the Vice President Liu, or Vice Premier Liu, to Washington next week for the talks, but has now canceled his trip, along with that of a mid-level delegation that was to precede him. Earlier Friday, a senior White House official said the U.S. was optimistic about finding a way forward in trade talks with China. The official told reporters at the White House that China must come to the table in a meaningful way for there to be progress on the trade dispute. And again, Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Charles Grassley has now given the woman who has accused a Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, of sexual assault until 2:30, that is 2.5 hours away, this Saturday to decide whether she'll testify. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea.
U.S. President Donald Trump returns to the United Nations for the annual gathering of world leaders.
Socializing, that was what I got unofficially from the observers whom I met in those stations where I also visited.
Voters in Eswatini choose new parliamentarians and community representatives.
We are also going to use parliament, demand members of parliament to pick the president because he has reached the hall, but also as well he has reached the heart of Malawi.
And civil society groups in Malawi pressure the government to resolve their concerns ahead of next year's elections. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. U.S. President Donald Trump returns to the United Nations next week for the annual gathering of world leaders after an international debut last year in which he threatened to totally destroy North Korea. Many are anxious about what message he may bring this year. VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir in New York has more on what to expect.
President Trump stunned the assembly last year.
The United States has great strength and patience. But if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
Relations between Washington and Pyongyang have improved dramatically since then, culminating in a summit in June. But direct talks have stalled, and the General Assembly could provide an opportunity to get them back on track. Diplomats will be listening to Trump's Tuesday speech for any indications of progress. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will not be in New York, but his foreign minister will be. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has invited his counterpart to meet, saying it would mark the beginning of negotiations intended to denuclearize North Korea by January 2021. While there has been positive movement on North Korea, that has not been the case with Iran, says Middle East Institute fellow Ahmed Majidyar.
While there has been some kind of progress, at least in terms of talks with North Korea, we are going reverse when it comes to Iran.
In May, President Trump withdrew the United States from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and reimposed sanctions. U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley is among the administration's most vocal critics of Tehran.
Across the Middle East, Iran has trampled on the sovereignty of its neighbors in Lebanon, in Syria, in Yemen. And the Iranian regime has shown a total disregard of the sovereignty of a country that is at a critical stage in its political development, Iraq.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani will be at the General Assembly and is likely to respond to any criticism leveled by President Trump, but don't expect a meeting between the two leaders. More than 125 presidents, prime ministers, and royals will attend the General Assembly, but there will be some notable exceptions. Russian President Vladimir Putin and Chinese President Xi Jinping are skipping the gathering. German Chancellor Angela Merkel will also be a no-show. And while North Korea and Iran may dominate the headlines, there will be work on many pressing global issues, including conflicts in the Middle East and Africa, global warming, and development. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Voters in Eswatini went to the polls to choose new parliamentarians and community representatives Friday. Local and international poll observers described the elections as peaceful and without any major incidents. But local media groups say Swaziland police closed bars and church services in an effort to force people to the polling stations to vote. To learn more about the elections, I reached Prince Gija, chairman of the Eswatini Electoral Commission.
our election, which was scheduled, was we hold elections every 5 years, like any other country here in the continent of Africa under SADC, as we are part of SADC, we are part of AU. We had our elections today, which opened up polling stations at 7 in the morning, and we have just closed our polling stations at 7 in the afternoon. Some stations haven't stopped voting because those were already online in the queue at 7 when we closed. They are allowed by the law to continue voting until everybody's finished. So we had a very, very peaceful election. Everybody came in their numbers. They were voting for a member of parliament and a local government, or we call him a constituency chairperson or headman.
How did Eswatinis comport themselves in this Friday's elections?
Most people, I think you can get that from the international observers who will maybe give you what they saw, because we had Africa Union here, we had SADC here, we had others from like Commonwealth was here, EU, some countries from EU were here. Or the way some people will always ask, are you in an election, or you are in a funfair or a bride day where people are roasting meat? Because you find outside the polling station, people are enjoying braai, they're enjoying meat. Everybody was just down to ground and doing their job, voting and walking out, you know, chatting with people, and after that going home. It was nice and calm.
So when will the outcome of these elections be announced by the Eswatini Electoral Commission?
Yes, the way we hold our elections, immediately after polling closes and everybody has voted, so they start counting immediately in front of the candidates and the agents. They start counting the votes. So immediately after polling, they start counting. So after counting, they might count from maybe 8 or 9 up to maybe 2 in the morning. The results are announced immediately. When they come to me from every constituency, mine to announce them, maybe on my post is Friday today, it will be Saturday tomorrow. We found out by Monday, I announced it's just a formality, but everybody knows who won where. And then I just do the formality to announce them comprehensively throughout the whole country, who want to be MP in that constituency and who want to be the head person in that constituency.
What was the feedback you got from the international poll observers who monitor these elections?
I haven't yet got an official feedback because I was driving from one polling station to the other. I covered a few polling stations before I came back to the office. I met some of the observers and they were happy. The first thing they will actually comment on was the peace, that it's so peaceful. No noises, but people are just sitting and chatting. People are having prizes. You know, outside the gates, you know, there's a lot of food being sold to people and people are socializing. That was what I got unofficially from the observers whom I met in those stations where I also visited.
Prince Gija is the chairman of the Eswatini Electoral Commission. He spoke with me from the capital, Mbabani. Civil society groups in Malawi say their protests across 4 major cities went well in spite of challenges. The groups say they sought a court injunction after authorities restricted the time for their protest in the capital, Lilongwe. But supporters of the ruling party say the demonstrations became political after leaders from the opposition joined the protest to attack the president and his administration. They called on the groups to constructively engage the government to address their concerns. For more about their protest, I reached Gift Trappings of the Human Rights Defenders Forum, a leading organizer of the protest.
It is true that we had many challenges because the government and the ruling party has been trying to block us to do the demonstration. They blocked us on 7 September, where Malawians were here to do the demonstration. But also, they gave us the authority to do the demonstration in the ninth hour. So it was very difficult for us to not do the demonstration, but as well as to tell Malawians where they can start the demonstration and also where they can end the demonstration. For example, in Lilongwe, they wanted us to do the demonstrations for only 2 hours. We had to go to court. So the court granted us an injunction to start the demonstrations from where we wanted to start and also from where wanted to deliver the petition to the government.
Since your demonstration went on despite the challenges, were you successful in presenting the petition to Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika, whom you needed to present the petition to about your concerns of the demonstrations?
We were successful to present the petition to the government because they sent the chief secretary in the office of the president and cabinet, but the president himself did not turn up, as the court demanded him to receive our petition. But all in all, a lot of people came out and they demonstrated. That shows that a lot of Malawians are in support of the issues that we are raising in the petition.
We heard reports that Lazarus Chakwera, the main opposition leader, presidential candidate for the Malawi Congress Party, participated in this demonstration and addressed the demonstration. Some people are saying you made the demonstration too political, and that is why it was seen by some people that if it is the civil society organizations that are going on demonstration expressing concern about things that are happening in the country, why make it political? Then you have members of the ruling party or supporters of the ruling party kicking against it, that the opposition is ganging up with the civil society against the government.
I think for us, Malawians are aware that we extended that message of people wanting to join our demonstrations. We wanted all Malawians of different backgrounds to join our demonstrations. So we have had endorsements from all the opposition political parties, but also we extended our message to the ruling party. For those who are feeling that corruption is bad in Malawi, we wanted also to join our demonstrations, but they didn't turn up. So we cannot bar people because they belong to the opposition, because these are also Malawians. They are also seeing the challenges that are going through in this country. So for us, the fact that the opposition leader came to our demonstration does not necessarily mean that it was sponsored by the opposition party. After all the ruling governments that we have had in this country, they have always accused the civil society organizations that they have been sponsored by the opposition. Why? Because we are the ones who have been fighting for the best interests of Malawi. So it's them who are political to accuse us, because they are the ones who have been blocking us to do the demonstrations. And even the president also defied court order, because he was supposed to receive our petition, but he didn't even turn up, thinking that he's above the law.
So where does this demonstration go from here?
I think we have a government that do not want to listen to Malawians. I think this is the African politics. They think that the taxpayer is the beggar. In fact, they don't know that the taxpayer is the employer. So for us, what we would want to do is to empower Malawians so that they should demand from the people that they have employed. So what we have done today is to tell the government that if they are not doing anything the next 90 days, we are going back into the streets. That's the first thing that we have also demanded. But also, if they are not addressing the issue, we are also going to use parliament, demand members of parliament to impeach the president, because he has breached the law, but also as well he has breached the trust of Malawians by allowing people to steal money that is supposed to, you know, contribute to the development of this country.
What if your 90-day ultimatum is not respected? Because I understand that the opposition doesn't have majority in parliament to impeach him for. And how will you empower Malawians to kick against some of these concerns in government that you have expressed?
This time we only did our demonstrations in 4 cities, but the next demonstrations we are going to do in all the districts of Malawi, including the rural areas. So people think that those people who are affected by blackouts of electricity are the ones who are only in the urban areas. So this time, the next demonstrations that we are going to do, we make sure that even the rural poor Malawians are also engaged, are also able to go into the streets to express their anger in the way how money is being stolen, which is supposed to contribute to the development, which is supposed to make sure that we have medicines in our hospitals.
Gift Trappens is leader of the Human Rights Defenders Forum. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. Cholera in Zimbabwe has claimed 30 lives and more than 7,000 cases have been reported in the capital Harare and Bulawayo. Cases of another waterborne disease, typhoid, have also been reported in the last few months in the city of Gweru. The government has declared a public health emergency in the capital, which is the worst affected area. Letitia Clay is the health delegate with the IFRC, the International Federation of the Red Cross. She spoke with VOA reporter William Eagle about what health officials call the double punch of typhoid and cholera in Zimbabwe.
Cholera and typhoid not really enable each other, but both are waterborne diseases. And so that is the correlation. And actually, cholera is a disease of iniquity. When you see today where cholera is, that's also often in the area where the people are most vulnerable. And actually, every death from cholera can be prevented with the tools we have today. It has been eliminated in Europe, North America, Latin America. So what will happen, for example, now we eliminate cholera or for now we try to prevent further infection. We kill two birds with one stone because also typhoid will be eliminated.
In comparison, how is typhoid spread? Are they not both waterborne illnesses?
Yes, they are both waterborne and endemic diseases, or in other words, they both cause epidemics. But both are caused by two different microorganisms. Though typhoid and cholera both are spread by eating or drinking contaminated food or water and caused by poor sanitation and poor hygiene. So in that case, there is a correlation.
Now, I understand that in Zimbabwe, authorities have taken some measures, for example, to prevent large public gatherings. So how easy is it to spread either cholera or typhoid in a large crowd of people, for example?
Let's talk about cholera. It's highly contagious because the bacteria, it's a bacteria, is present in the fetus of an infected person. And a similar situation, like now in Zimbabwe, where a couple of areas, the sanitation is lacking. And people are congested. It can spread rather swiftly because, for example, a woman who is infected is selling her food and vegetables. She hasn't washed her hands very properly after going to the bathroom. And so the apples and the vegetables are contaminated. Okay, people buy from her and they do not wash it properly and then also get infected. And let's imagine that there's one woman infects 50 people and then these people infect 30 others. That is already 2,500 people. So that is why, you know, cholera can be spread so easily. Yeah, in addition, these days, people travel far and fast. So there is a risk here. Yeah.
And is that the case for typhoid as well? The spread would be similar by, for example, touching someone in a crowd or touching produce that has been infected.
Correct. The touching of products. Yeah, correct.
What are some of the challenges facing health workers? I have read that some say there is a resistance to some of the older drugs used. And also, what do aid workers need to protect themselves from catching the illness?
Let me start with protecting. The Red Cross volunteers who are involved in dissemination of the messages to prevent cholera, they have to perform what we call the usual prevention measures themselves, and that is washing hands, drinking water that is purified, and careful preparation of food. In clinics, sometimes more measures are taken. Doctors and nurses can be asked to be wading through chlorinated water when entering the patient room. But that's also not even always the case. I have been in clinics when there was cholera. It's not always. Using gloves, but even that is not always done. Talking about the drugs, actually in cholera we hardly use drugs, only for the really severe cases. But we use oral rehydration. The moment we use oral rehydration, then the casualties can even be can go lower as 5%. That is really very effective. And that's also why now Zimbabwe volunteers, more than thousands, are performing drama, in, for example, in the street to disseminate messages related to prevention of cholera, but also when you have cholera, what you have to do. They teach teachers and students, they go to churches, marketplaces, industrial areas, etc.
Are the same measures taken for the prevention of typhoid as well?
Yeah, for typhoid, more antibiotics is used, and sometimes there can be resistance, but it's not really resistant at the moment.
That was Letitia Clay of the IFRC. She spoke with viewers William Eagle from Johannesburg, South Africa. Right groups are calling for the release of an ex-finance minister arrested after publishing a two-volume book critical of the Eritrean government. Viewer Salem Solomon has the story from Washington.
Four security agents detained Berhane, a 74-year-old veteran of Eritrea's war for independence, while he was walking with his son in the capital Asmara, according to Salomon Haptom, a nephew.
They kind of abducted him. It was not like they came home, they took him to prison. It was an abduction. People who saw it witnessed that. It's an unfortunate tragedy, but this is the true nature of the government. Isaias has security agents who do that, and this is a continuation of his practice.
He said, referring to President Isaias Afwerki, who has ruled the country since it broke away from Ethiopia in 1991. Berhane hasn't been charged with anything, nor has the government made any statements regarding his arrest. The arrest drew condemnation from human rights organizations, including Amnesty International.
We ask the Eritrean government to release Berhane Abraham unconditionally and immediately, and also his wife, Almaz Haptamariam.
His wife, Almaz Haptamariam, was previously arrested for helping her son leave the country without a required exit visa and has been in prison for more than a year, according to a family member and Amnesty. The two-part book, Hagere Eritrea, or My Country Eritrea, includes sharp criticisms of the government and calls for reforms in the country. Berhane takes direct aim at Isaias, saying he rules the country like a tornado, flip-flops on issues, and is perceived to suffer from schizophrenia. The writings have caused a stir among the Eritrean diaspora. Passages have circulated online and paperbacks have been shipped to the U.S. and Canada and distributed at launch events, including one in Washington. In a recorded message posted on YouTube earlier this month, Berhane demanded a public showdown with the president. I am calling on you to debate me in front of the people of Eritrea on national television, he said, speaking in Tigrinya. I hope you will accept my invitation for debate and respond. Our debating points will focus on past and future plans of political, economic, and cultural and social issues of the country. Such provocations are virtually unheard of in the tightly controlled country, and Berhane's arrest didn't come as a surprise.
And everybody has expected that he's going to be arrested, because that was the trend in Eritrea, and what happened was expected. That's horrible, because this old man is being held incommunicado, and no one knows where he is right now.
Berhane studied economics and engineering in Illinois, but he returned to Eritrea to join the struggle for independence in 1975. He now joins a long list of former government officials, sometimes known as the G15, who have been imprisoned in Eritrea since 2001. Fesaha Tekle is the Horn of Africa researcher for Amnesty International.
It's a very sad story for the family and also for the country. As you may remember, September marks the 17th year since members of G15 have been arrested in Eritrea. No one has heard about them for the last 17 years. No one knows their final fate, what happened to them. So he's going to join his compatriots there.
The arrest has also left some wondering about the prospects of reform in Eritrea following a historic peace deal with Ethiopia and other regional players.
It's not only about Berhane. Berhane is a symbol. We are happy for the peace process between Ethiopia and Eritrea, but we also want to see end of this kind of dictatorship in the country.
Salem Solomon for VOE News, Washington, D.C.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the UN Children's Fund warns thousands of refugee and migrant children are living in dire and dangerous conditions in squalid, overcrowded facilities on the Greek islands. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The UN Children's Fund reports more than 7,000 refugee and migrant children are living under horrible, unsanitary conditions on the Greek islands. On average, it says more than 850 children make the dangerous sea journey to Greece every month, only to end up in facilities that are congested and lacking all basic necessities. UNICEF's country coordinator in Greece, Lucio Melandri, says he was appalled by what he saw on a recent visit to centers on the islands of Lesbos and Samos. While there, he says he met refugee children from Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and the Democratic Republic of Congo.
The vast majority of the children are deeply traumatized. Many have lived through war and have had to flee their homes. They have survived, but now find themselves living in horrible condition with no hand in sight. For many children, they simply cannot cope.
Melandri says housing on the islands are totally unacceptable. For example, he notes the Moria Center on the island of Lesbos hosts nearly 9,000 people in a facility meant for 3,000. He says the center on Samos, built for 650 people, houses 4,000. He says staff is overwhelmed and warns services in these centers could collapse in the coming winter months. UNICEF says all refugees and migrants living in the centers, especially children, must be transferred to the mainland without further delay. It says these vulnerable people must be given adequate accommodation, protection, health care, and other basic services. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Afrochella is a festival designed to highlight and elevate thriving millennial talent with African roots. Organizers say the festival is an interactive event that encourages collaboration, explains and explores culture with a pioneering approach. The aim of the festival, they said, is to tell the new African story from a native perspective. For more, I'm joined live in the VOA studios here in Washington by Abdul Karim Abdullah and Edward Asafueje, organizers of the festival. So, Abdul, let me come to you.
Okay.
What does Afrochella mean to you?
Well, Afrochella was an opportunity for us to be able to show some of the emerging talent that's growing in Ghana or in Africa across the board. We wanted to create a space where visitors that come to Ghana in December are able to collaborate, are able to explore the experiences of each other, and utilize that as hopefully a way to engage in a conversation around building within Africa or showing what it is that we're capable of building within Africa.
Edward.
Yeah, to add to what Abdul is saying, Afrochella, basically, in terms of entertainment in Ghana especially, it's usually just a music concert or an arts festival. There's rarely a case where there's both. There's a one-stop shop for arts, African cuisine, and entertainment.
When will this festival begin?
We had one last year. Last year was our first one, 29th December. This year, 29th December again, at Elwak Sports Stadium.
So will this be a yearly affair?
Yes,
we plan for it to be a yearly affair.
But you
talked about it being an Afrocentric
correct
festival.
Correct.
So are you going to have artists from across the continent?
Yes. So we plan to have artists from across the continent. We plan to highlight art from across the continent as well. We also wanted to take an opportunity to give people a try of opportunity to try food from other tribes and other cultures, other countries as well. We just want to create a space where we're supporting each other and we're building each other and we understand each other. And hopefully that would make us look like we're open for business.
All right. So you talked about the fact that Afrochella is telling the African story.
Yeah.
What is this new African story? Let me come to you, Edward, first, and then we come to you, Abdul.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The African story. Basically, we feel like a lot of African creatives are not getting their due shine or are not getting their proper acknowledgement. So this festival is basically a canvas for young African creatives such as myself, Abdul. We have visual artists, musical artists, basically every form of art, to come and showcase your talent and let everybody else see that we can. It can be done here too, just as much as it can be done everywhere else. That's what we are trying to push the most. That's what we are like pioneering for.
I agree. Almost everything that we have with regards to Afrochella is made in Africa, and I think that surprises people. So from our artwork to our website, everything was built in Africa, and that's some of the talent that even I was impressed that we have in Ghana that are capable of building these things. And so we want to utilize our platform in Afrochella, being able to bring out 5,000 people last year, to show companies around the world like, wow, there's talent in Africa, and we need to explore that talent.
Well, since you talked about telling the new African story, will this new Afrochella festival be expanded to other African countries south of the Sahara?
Yeah, we plan to try to go to other countries. I mean, it's one of our goals, obviously. We want to be able to expand the festival beyond one day, make it a two-day event, possibly add other aspects of it, include workshops where people can actually learn something and build things, introduce companies that can come and connect with some of the talent that are there. And hopefully, once we establish in Ghana a lot more than we have currently, we can expand to other countries.
How do you pay for this?
Last year we self-funded. We were able to build out, and luckily we were able to make it happen. We had help from BBNZ Live in Ghana as well. They supported us very well. Jameson also supported us last year. This year we're hoping that we're going to get some sponsorships. We're talking to a few African companies that are looking to possibly give us some money.
Well, some people are saying that since you want to expand to other parts of Africa, particularly the sub-Saharan African continent, do you expect to see other countries get involved? Have you contacted other African countries in the near future to get involved in this Afrochella festival?
It's funny because a lot of representatives from other countries have started contacting us. Even last year, before the first festival, after the announcement, we had people from Amsterdam wanting to expand there already and stuff. So it's definitely in a conversation. It's definitely something we're looking at. But I want to make sure it's well established. It's well established in Ghana first, and then we expand everywhere else.
How were you received the first time of this happening in Ghana? And did you have any support from the authorities to allow you to expand possibly this year, since you said you had 5,000 people? Yeah. Do you expect more?
Honestly, when we started, when the idea came about, we knew that we had something, but we didn't expect it to grow as fast as it did last year. Last year, it grew exponentially fast, but luckily, we were able. Our planning allowed us to be able to secure and ensure that it was a great event. This year, we plan to get some support from tourism. They plan to support us in some way or shape or form. We're looking forward to the finalization of that, but we hope that in the future, we'll get more governmental support, we'll get more institutional support within Ghana and around Africa, and hopefully that will help expand it and help drive more companies to come into Africa and, you know, obviously maybe activate within our festival, activate around the country in hopes of, you know, giving opportunities to people who are within Ghana. You know.
What about the cooperation with the Ghanaian Arts Council, or for that matter, the artists in Ghana? You talked about some of these new up-and-coming artists. What about the legends, so to speak?
It's funny you say that, because this year we have a surprise up the sleeve, as far as, you know, and bringing back some legends go. It's something we've definitely considered, and we're making happen this year. We don't want to give too much.
Don't let
away.
It out the bag yet. Yeah. Don't let it out the bag yet.
We didn't even want to say we have someone, but since you brought it up, yeah, like this,
now,
we
have. Abdul, before you go, okay, what is the message here for this December Afrochella Festival?
Well, the message is Africa is open for business. You can find any type of talent that you're looking for. We're available for you. But also, we're also a place that we can collaborate with each other across continents. All of us are doing amazing things within our respective countries and towns and careers. And I think that we can use that for the benefit of Africa.
All right. Thank you very much, Abdul Karim Abdullah and Edward Asafwe Jia, organizers of the Afrochella Festival. They joined me live here in the viewing studios here in Washington, D.C.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
Sunday, I love you. Oh, kitanda naichumia hiyo kote kiona kwa juu chini meza mia hiyo kote
sungura nipe karoti marage sijazoea
hiyo kote
na kunja kote na vanisha mori na chichimea oh yeah baby baby
ukitoka kuoga nitenge ya moto moto Tinga moka kitenge, tutoke mtoko ah, Boda kwa boda tuteme, chocho kwa chocho Tena nikichoka ni bebe, mikwako mtoto yeye Rafuzi ya pemba rangi rangi Nyule kihindi chambi chambi na Cheza rafu kona bambi Moto baridi zigane Kama roba kugane Tue wote
Ooh, yeah.
Oh, kambe bikambe Sumari kwa nyundo kugonge Oh, Monday to Sunday I love you mm-hmm. Oh, basi Yokote So kwa bedi kwa kochi kitanda naichumia Yokote Kiona kwa juu chini meza mia Yokote
Sungura nipe karoti marage sijazoea
Yokote
Na kunja goti na vandisha mori na chichimea
The Mix Killer
Katanu didi Aba Bomisha
Yaha, yaha
Nekatanu didi
Aba
Bomisha
No didi Kilikatu
Kilibe, kilibe, kilibe nu baby yo
Omalicha
Kilibe, kilibe, kilibe nu baby yo Baby the sharp From head to toe, baby, I like that crystal, baby, yo. Today na yo de, wado Bengali yo.
Mwa
pichava, 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 no baby yo.
Hey, nakata no didi yo, baby, more in the heart. So different yo, baby, more in buliche. Anyangu tutu, mwachuku kelumbo siuka Confidence, oh, baby, mama loko Nakata nudidi, oh, nakata nudidi, oh, baby, oh Lele no, enene menjalu
Oya putavanu, iyewe jekwe mwe Oya lechavanu, oya tekwe kwa mwe Asa menitewe, iyewe jekwe mwe Oh, yes, so rooted. Oh, yeah, they're for a moment. I got me burumanya, put your papa kio. And you guess up one, they call us a monarchy.
I want to give you a ring, oh, my love. Oh. I want to take you to church, oh, my love. Oh, baby, oh, it will be you, nobody better than me. Nakata no didi, oh, baby, more in the heart. Oh, different, oh, baby, more in puliche. Anyamu tutu, machuku kelumba siuka. Confidence, oh, baby, more malako. Nakata no didi, oh, nakata no didi, oh, baby, oh, lele no.
Oya putavano, iyewe jekwe mele Oya lechavano, oya tekwe kwa mume Asa menitewe, iyewe jekwe mele se oya suru gebe oya tepe kwa mume aga meburu manya bujere papa kiyo anige se kwane koko siye muna kiyo.
I want to give you a ring, oh my love, oh. I want to take you to church, oh my love, oh.
Alléluia.
In service express.
was Music from the Continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America and from the rest of the Nightline team. Reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite. We say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, you cannot frighten the chief warrior with the size of your mustache. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The political situation in Zimbabwe has deteriorated since the disputed July 30th presidential election, in which incumbent President Emmerson Mnangagwa was declared the winner over challenger Nelson Chamisa by a narrow margin. The United States is gravely concerned by credible reports of numerous detentions, beatings, and other abuses of Zimbabweans, in particular targeting of opposition activists, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert. She went on to say there is no role for violence, intimidation, or harassment in the new Zimbabwe. In another development, Ms. Nauert expressed deep concern over the fact that Zambia chose to hand over former Zimbabwean Minister of Finance Tendai Biti to the Zimbabwean authorities, and in the face of reported Zambian court order blocking his expulsion from Zambia. In addition to being former finance minister, Mr. Biti is a senior figure in the Movement for Democratic Change. This decision is particularly disheartening, said Ms. Nauert, given the courage that Zambia showed in sheltering thousands of Zimbabwean freedom fighters from Rhodesian aggression in the days of Zimbabwe's independence struggle. U.S. officials will be discussing this matter with Zambia's leaders. The government of Zimbabwe is now responsible for Tendai Biti's safety and welfare, cautioned Ms. Nauert. We call on Zimbabwe's leaders to guarantee Mr. Biti's physical safety and ensure his constitutional and human rights are respected, consistent with the rule of law and Zimbabwe's international obligations and commitments. In an effort to register its gravest concerns, the United States convoked the ambassadors of both Zimbabwe and Zambia. A judge has since released Biti on conditional bail. He remains under house arrest. Zimbabwe had a historic opportunity to move the country toward a brighter future for all its citizens, but an electoral process marred by violence that does not respect constitutional rights and procedures is not a step towards that future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is VOA News.